Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. On June 28th, the elected president of Honduras, Manuel Zelaya, was arrested by the Honduran military in the middle of the night and flown into exile. It was the first military coup in Central America since the end of the Cold War. But it's not a simple story. Zelaya's backers say he was standing up for the poor with encouragement from Venezuela's Hugo Chavez. His opponents say they were standing up for constitutional democracy. Now the U.S. is in the thick of it. This hour, On Point, the big story behind the coup in Honduras and what comes next. You can join the conversation. What do you see unfolding in the story of this coup? And where should Washington put its weight in the search for resolution? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We're scheduled to go right to the Honduran capital, Tegucigalpa, but we're having trouble with the phone lines into Honduras at the moment. We'll keep trying. Joining me now from Atlanta, Georgia, is Jennifer McCoy. She's a professor of political science at Georgia State University and director of the Americas Program at the Carter Center in Atlanta. She's an expert on democracy in Latin America and is editor of the book The Unraveling of Representative Democracy in Venezuela. Jennifer McCoy, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom. It's a pleasure to be here.
Give us a little background on what's going on here. Manuel Zelaya, elected in 05, took office in 06, was supposed to be in office until next year. He's out. He's leftist, but he's a wealthy rancher, a timber tycoon who became a populist supporter of an agenda for the poor. Is that why he's out?
Well, that's part of it. It's a very interesting case and very complex case, actually. But yes, I think that it goes back to political disputes that arose when he changed his kind of political direction and program, because he was elected on a more conservative platform, as you mentioned. And then he began to try to carry out some reforms in the country and some pro-poor reforms, and ran into some resistance from different sectors of the population and from the Congress for some of his reforms. Also ran into a bit of a conflict with the IMF and the World Bank for some of the things he wanted to do. And I think that at that point he turned to Venezuela for the kind of economic support that he could get more easily, say without the conditions. And he actually joined the coalition that Venezuela had started called the ALBA, which was sort of an alternative to free trade agreements that the U.S. was pushing. And so he could get, you know, some cheap petroleum and some other economic aid. But this political realignment, I think, touched off a number of fears in other sectors of the population about where he was really going, and fears that he might be wanting to go more in the direction of Venezuela, including not just a presidential reelection, which is prohibited by the Honduran Constitution, but the general economic line in Venezuela. There have been a number of nationalizations, a closeness to Cuba, and and allegations of curtailment of some freedoms, et cetera. So a lot of fear was raised within the population, and I think a lot of presumptions and suspicions, perhaps not based on fact, but just presumptions about where he would be going, that actually led to the final result on Sunday.
When you say fear within the population, I wonder if you can describe more precisely what you mean. Honduras is now the third poorest country in the Western Hemisphere. Only Haiti and Nicaragua are poorer than Honduras. 70% of the population there, I read, living in poverty. He had pushed for higher minimum wage and some other, as you say, steps on the behalf of those poor. Were the poor upset by the direction he was taking? Or was it the business class that was upset? How's it break down?
Yes, it seems that it was a combination of his political former allies in the Congress, his own party. Some of the party seemed to divide. And the other major party of the country. So in the Congress, he was losing support, was unable to get some of his nominations for Supreme Court and other positions affirmed, was unable to get some of his policies affirmed. So he was fighting with the Congress. And within the population, it seemed that the population was becoming more and more divided. And certainly his support appears to lie more in the rural areas and among the lower classes. And the opponents and those who seem to be supporting the coup tend to be more in the middle and upper classes. So I think that this reflects what we're seeing in a lot of Latin America, where people who have felt excluded, particularly the poor, both rural and urban poor and organized, have felt unrepresented by their democracies, and in several cases have been actually using their democratic rights to vote in new independent presidents. And this happened in the case of Venezuela, it happened in the case of Bolivia, presidents who were running on a mandate to bring about some radical change and that would redistribute resources in the country. Now, he didn't run on that platform, but he began to move more toward that line. And so he was, I think, gaining support within some the popular classes, the lower classes in Honduras, but also, you know, raising some fears in more of the upper classes and some of the middle classes.
And of critics who said he was actually undoing the constitutional democracy that Honduras, of course, for a long time didn't have and now does. Let's hear from the ousted president himself. Here's Manuel Zelaya on tape speaking to reporters. With translation here, from Costa Rica on June 29th. This is the day after he was hauled out in his pajamas by the military.
I've been the victim of a kidnap by a group of Honduran soldiers. I don't think the whole army is supporting this interruption of the democratic system by capturing a president elected by the people. I think this has been a plot by a brazen elite whose only wish is to keep this country isolated and in total poverty. They don't care about the people, and the heads of the armed forces have betrayed and deceived me. They've come to my house in the early hours of the morning and firing guns. They broke the doors with bayonets and they threatened to shoot me. It really was a brutal kidnap. They did this to me for no reason, apart from my wish to improve Honduras and to install a democratic system.
Ousted Honduran President Manuel Zelaya speaking from Costa Rica, where he was dumped out of the country on June 28th. This is the next day. He sat down with Secretary of State Hillary Clinton in Washington yesterday, and there are reports out of that meeting that she asked him, what have Latin American presidents learned from Honduras? And he replied with a smile, to sleep with our clothes on and our bags packed. Jennifer McCoy in Atlanta, what was the precipitating move by ousted President Zelaya that set off the chain of events that led to his ouster? He was trying to have the Constitution changed so that he could stay in office. This is specifically forbidden. It's a one-term presidency in the Honduran Constitution.
Yes, it's interesting, and I think there's been some misperception of that. As I understand it, the precipitating factor was, in fact, his call for a constituent assembly, which he had made last year, but it hadn't really picked up steam until about March, when he issued a decree and called for a popular consultation, which is like a referendum, mm-hmm. To ask the people, would they like to put on the ballot in November, when they had already scheduled national elections, a question which people could then vote on in an official referendum to say, would you like to call for a constituent assembly that would then write a new constitution? So this vote or consultation or survey, as he called it, that was supposed to happen on June 28th, was not actually approving a constituent assembly, and it definitely was not approving a question about re-election. It didn't say anything about that. It was just a question, do you want to put a question on the ballot in November? So there's been some misperception of that in the reporting.
Still, he was touching a kind of third rail here, wasn't he? I mean, in the Honduran Constitution, as I read here, one of the eight so-called firm articles, those that cannot be changed, is the term limit on the presidency. What was the complaint that this is the kind of the Hugo Chavez playbook, beginning to play fast and loose, whatever the interest may be, and people may support the interest he represents, but fast and loose with the constitutional structure of the state?
That was exactly the fear. I think the problem here and the reason the international community reacted so strongly against this was that this was based on the fear that a call for constituent assembly meant trying to change that article prohibiting re-election. when in fact he didn't propose that in any official way. And so that's the whole question, and this is where it turns around this the legal question, which has to be dealt with within Honduras, of what are the unconstitutional acts that he committed, and what, you know, what were the fears of what he might be trying to commit in the future.
Well, what other sort of rationale might there be for raising the question that he raised there, other than to bring into question the term limit?
Well, the Honduran current constitution, dating back to 1982, allows for two ways to reform the constitution. One, in one article, it says that it must be done by a two-thirds vote of the Congress in two different sessions. In another article, it says there are these mechanisms for the people to participate through referendum and plebiscites, and these questions can deal with reforms of the Constitution. And so a referendum can bring about a change in the Constitution as well. So part of the problem is, I think, maybe a lack of clarity in the Constitution itself.
But clearly a divided government. I mean, the Supreme Court ended up against him, the Congress ended up against him,
exactly.
And clearly the military ended up against him.
All of the institutions ended up against him. That's exactly right. And he was isolated, and that had been building the last 2 years, his kind of political isolation against, particularly as I mentioned, in the Congress. But the question is, would there be other reasons to change the Constitution except for that one clause on reelection? And so the point I wanted to make is, calling for a constituent assembly through a referendum appears to be allowed by the Constitution to make various kinds of reforms to it.
Jennifer, please hold that thought. Jennifer McCoy in Atlanta. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the coup in Honduras, the story behind it, and the standoff over what comes next. The ousted leader, Manuel Zelaya, was quite close to Venezuela's sort of fiery socialist, leftist, populist, man of the people, Hugo Chavez. He spoke about the ouster blaming the United States and saying that they ought to get in there and get active right away to fix it.
The North American Empire, the Yankee Empire, has a lot to do with this. The President of the United States should come forward immediately. I call him to come forward and, like us from deep down inside, to reject this attack, an attack that's not only against Honduras, but against the Latin American people, against dignity, against true democracy. It's the middle classes, the extreme right.
Venezuela's Hugo Chavez after the coup in Honduras. In Russia yesterday, President Barack Obama talked about the issue, expressing American support for Zelaya.
America supports now the restoration of the democratically elected president of Honduras, even though he has strongly opposed American policies. We do so not because we agree with him. We do so because we respect the universal principle that people should choose their own leaders, whether they are leaders we agree with or not.
President Obama in Russia yesterday. We have more voices coming in from around the country and from Central America. Let's get a call right here from Omaha, Nebraska. And Peter, hi, Peter, you're on the air. What do you think?
Hi, Tom. I was calling because I've been putting some thought into the issue, because it seemed to me that a lot of arguments on the right side of American politics are claiming that he was acting outside of his constitutional bounds, while the Obama administration is claiming that the Honduran Supreme Court and military were in the wrong. So I was putting some thought into it, and it occurred to me that whether or not the president was acting outside of his constitutional bounds, the Honduran Supreme Court and military did not go through an appropriate legal procedure for impeaching the president. Rather, it seemed that they went ahead and went through a military coup, which seems to me to be extra legal. So I wasn't sure what in the Honduran Constitution, what the appropriate procedures for removing the president were in the Honduran Constitution.
Right. Might there be a better way? Clearly, in bedclothes, in the night, doesn't seem like the right way, but then it's a complicated picture. Peter, in Omaha, we'll come to that. Let me get one more call here from Stan in Brookline, Massachusetts. Stan, what do you see?
Well, my wife, and my daughter are going to Honduras tomorrow. My daughter is born in Honduras, and we're going to go visit her town mm-hmm. in Honduras. And I have some thoughts about democracy on this. First, if in fact this was a similar situation in our country, if a president, contrary to the Supreme Court, contrary to Congress, were to decide to unilaterally extend his presidency, I think our people would be up in arms about this. This is also not what everyone calls a coup in any traditional sense. There is no army in charge down there. And for our country to be wishy-washy about this in terms of supporting a president who by his actions has dismissed himself from the presidency seems to me to be a problem for our country.
It's a thicket, not easy. You're right. If the Supreme Court had come to some decision like this about an American president, that would be pretty complicated.
And if the Congress had done similarly.
On the other hand, you've got big interests at work here, and we know that from Latin America. Stan, I appreciate your perspective, and I wish you good luck on your family's trip to Honduras. Let me get one more call here from Virginia Beach, Virginia. Paul, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. This is Paul. I lived half of my life on a dictatorial regime, supposedly elected by the people like Chavez in Venezuela, and I congratulate the coup, and that was a great thing because we don't need another Chavez or Castro next door to our country. And we got to get a lesson from that one in our country, too. The first caller before me, he was more than right. But that's all my comment, though.
So no thanks, you say, to another Chavez. We'll talk with our guests about whether that's how they see Manuel Zelaya. Thanks very much for your call in Virginia, Paul. Jennifer Coy's with us, McCoy from Atlanta, Georgia. With us now from Washington is Peruvian commentator Alvaro Vargas Llosa, senior fellow at the Center on Global Prosperity at the Independent Institute. His op-ed essay headlined, "Honduras' Coup is President Zelaya's Fault," appeared in the Washington Post on July 1st. Alvaro Vargas Llosa, thank you very much for being here.
Hello, thanks for having me.
So, how do you see what's going on? You've been very critical of Hugo Chavez, of Fidel Castro. Your own father ran as a conservative for president in Peru, so maybe we know right off the bat. But how do you see what's going on?
He would question the term conservative. He's a more of a libertarian.
All right.
That's a different issue. Mm-hmm. I see it very differently from how your other guest sees it. We have basically a tragedy brought about by two coups, as it were. One that was underway, led by Zelaya. He was clearly placing himself outside of the law, trying to subvert democracy from within, exactly in the way that Chavez has done in Venezuela, and in the way that Correa is trying to do in Ecuador, and Morales is trying to do in Bolivia, and perhaps Daniel Ortega is going to do, and he has sort of announced some measures in that respect in Nicaragua. This is the new authoritarian populism in Latin America. You come to power through legal means, you get elected, you come into office, and then you start to dismantle the institutions of democracy with the argument that you want to help the poor and you want to help the people. We've been there in Latin America before, and all that does is creates a wonderful cover, ideological cover, for authoritarianism, or, in the worst-case scenario, it triggers military coups in response. And then either way, you've done away with democracy. So this is what was happening. He was not only outside of the law, he was repeatedly outside of the law. He had been told by the Supreme Court, by Congress, by his own party, for God's sake. This is very important to understand. The Liberal Party, this was not the military, this was the Liberal Party, his own party that brought him to power. He was told that he was outside of the law. And why was he outside of the law? Because the Constitution is very clear. Not only does it say that the only way to change the Constitution is with two-thirds majority in Congress, it also says that you can hold referendums, but not with the aim of changing the very basic articles in the Constitution that relate to things like term limits. It's very clear about that. Mm. So he persisted, and he did so with the very open help of Chavez, who was constantly on the airwaves giving support to this measure. And according to many reports, this has not been confirmed, but these reports keep coming in. Zelaya had asked Chavez to print the ballots that he was going to use for this referendum. It's true that he changed from a referendum to a poll when the Supreme Court told him that the referendum was illegal. But why would you, 5 months before the elections, hold a poll asking people to change the Constitution if it wasn't because you wanted to force the situation and create an environment in which you might pursue your original dream, which was to get reelected? So this is the context in which the coup happened. Now, I think it was absolutely wrong for the military to step in. There was a process here, a civilian process, a legal process to impeach him, in which the Congress, the Supreme Court, the Human Rights Ombudsman, all the important institutions were involved. And I think it was terribly wrong for the military to step in, because it turned Zelaya into a victim. It created this very awkward scenario. And, of course, it just forced the international community to come to his support.
But Mr. Vargas,
disregard the context in which this had taken place.
But there, of course, is a bigger context. Let me ask you about that. You call this a move toward authoritarian populism. I'm sure you'd put the same tag on Hugo Chavez's government.
Mm-hmm.
But we heard earlier from Jennifer McCoy saying that, you know, any number of populations in Latin America, the poor in particular, have come to feel unrepresented by their democracies. Now, it sounds like an oxymoron, like a contradiction in terms, but maybe it's not. I mean, these are populations that stay poor decade after decade. Maybe the democracy somehow just wasn't working for them as structured. What do you say to that?
Well, there's no question that vast segments of the population in many Latin American countries feel unrepresented or underrepresented. They feel very skeptical about the institutions of democracy. They feel very skeptical about any kind of representative institution, including, of course, the political parties. And that's what has created this environment in which populist authoritarianism has taken root in some countries, not everywhere. I mean, you've got other important countries in the region that are much more modern, where there's a growing middle class, and where this phenomenon is not taking place, at least not with intensity. But yes, I mean, there's no question that is absolutely true. But this is not really the discussion here, because we have learned in the recent Latin American history that we need to establish democratic frameworks under the rule of law, within which we can have this very important discussion about what the right social policy is. But once you use social policy and your connection to the people and 21st century socialism, as Chavez calls it, and other Chavez allies also call it, to subvert democracy and to change the rules of the game and concentrate a lot of power in your hands, then this is no longer the real discussion. The real discussion is democracy versus authoritarianism, whether it comes from the left or the right. I think we need to point out to our listeners also that by all indications, Zelaya has the support of about a third of the people, which is not bad, but it's also the case that he has two-thirds of the country against him, and this is one of the poorest countries in Latin America and the poorest one in the Central American
region. By all indications, but I mean, George Bush had, less than a third of Americans behind him at the end, and he wasn't tossed out by the military.
But he wasn't tossed out because he didn't have more than a third of the support. He was tossed out, obviously, because he had placed himself outside of the law. He had only 5 months ago. What would the military gain by kicking him out of the country 5 months before the election
That's a good question.
Huge international response.
That's a good question.
I think that Zelaya wanted to cause a conflict that would just basically turn this equation not into what it was, which was him placing himself outside the law and the country resisting him, but between him, the champion of the poor and victim of the military, against the classic old-fashioned Latin American dictatorship. And that's what he's achieved to some extent.
Jennifer McCoy, what do you make of this? Alvaro Vargas Llosa says people should stay within the framework of the Constitution, otherwise you end up in this authoritarian realm where nothing's good. On the other hand, a lot of poor in Honduras and other Latin American countries may say, look, we've waited and waited. We've got to do something here. How do you look at that, Jennifer?
Well, I certainly agree that everyone should be staying within the framework of the Constitution, and I agree that Zelaya defied the Supreme Court in terms of its rulings against holding his survey or consultation on June 28th. However, the question still is the reaction. And again, I go back to the point, and here's where I disagree with Alvaro Vargas Llosa, that the question is what he had done already and what he could have done. And again, I think it's based more on the fear of what he would be able to do. He was asking on June 28th to put a question on a ballot November 29th when they were going to elect a new president who would take office in January of the next year. So if the question for a constituent assembly was only going to be brought to the voters on November 29th at the same time that they were electing a new president, then the question I have been asking is how could that have been accomplished in time to change, to write a new constitution, have it in place in the 2 months when you first have to elect a constituent assembly, and allow for presidential reelection when the election's already been held? I mean, the whole thing seems rather absurd, and even his call to try to do this so late in the game seems strange to me. But you know, so that's why I think that the whole question of or assumption that he was going for re-election has to be questioned, because I just don't see how physically or logistically it could have been put in place in time before the next president takes office.
Lots of questions about motive here. We've heard from Omaha and Virginia and Boston. Let's hear from Burlington, Vermont. Dorothy, you're on the air.
Hello. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I've been to Honduras, and I had a Honduran husband, and when so poor a country that I think the people in the United States just don't understand, and they think it's a democracy, but it really isn't. It's run by the foreigners who manage and own the multinational corporations where they grow the pineapples, coffee, sugar, and the people work for those corporations for pennies. I mean, they don't earn enough to hardly survive. They can't own land, they can't own even chickens outside their company-owned little shacks. You know, it's just, they get picked up in trucks from high up on these horrible mountains, and it's just a horrible situation. And to call it a regular democracy where the people elected, it's ridiculous.
But what about Alvaro Vargas Llosa says if you're not careful, you end up with authoritarian populism? What do you say to that, Dorothy?
I'd say we have authoritarianism there now, which is why so many of the people are so poor. It's run by the foreigners who own the corporation.
Dorothy, thanks for calling. Alvaro Vargas Llosa, we just have a minute before the break. What do you say in response?
Well, I mean, I'm sure many Hondurans would be very surprised to hear that, because they lived under dictatorship until the end of the 70s. I mean, true military dictatorship, and it was horrific. And you had the typical situation where the military just was not accountable, and they committed atrocious violations of human rights. And ever since 1982, under the new constitution, you've had a democracy, the rule of law. Yes, a Honduran democracy, not Jeffersonian democracy, but it was trying to consolidate itself, and it had made incredible progress. And that's what's so tragic about this situation. Then when this process was underway, everything now is interrupted because Zelaya tried to establish an authoritarian type of populist regime, and it triggered the kind of response that in the past has led to military dictatorship. So this is what's tragic about this.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the standoff over the presidency of Honduras, the story behind it, and what comes next after the ouster there on June 28th of elected President Manuel Zelaya. Of course, he was flying over the airport in Tegucigalpa, trying to return by air, speaking on loudspeaker to people on the tarmac, blocked from returning this week, sat down with Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, and has finally agreed, we now read, to some kind of negotiated settlement. Both sides in this dispute have agreed. Oscar Arias of Costa Rica, neighboring Costa Rica, has been recruited, a Nobel Prize winner, to come in and try and work this out. Hillary Clinton told reporters after her meeting with ousted President Zelaya yesterday that she was heartened by that, that he was not going to try to barge back into the country, but to enter into dialogue.
I believe that is a better route for him to follow at this time than to attempt to return in the face of the implacable opposition of the de facto regime. And so instead of another confrontation that might result in the loss of life Let's try the dialogue process and see where that leads, and let the parties determine all the various issues as they should. It's their responsibility to do that.
U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton speaking yesterday after her meeting with ousted Honduran President Manuel Zelaya. We've been joined by Jennifer McCoy from the Carter Center in Atlanta, by Alvaro Vargas Llosa in Washington at the Center on Global Prosperity, the Independent Institute there. We're joined right now from Guatemala City in Guatemala by Greg Grandin. He's professor of history at New York University. He had a piece in The Nation on June 30th, headlined Democracy Derailed in Honduras. Professor Grandin, thanks for joining us. What do you see going on in Honduras?
Well, I think that that Jennifer's analysis was basically correct, that this was a procedural issue. And one thing that troubles me the most, though, is this tendency to see the conflict through an almost obsession, a prism of obsession with Hugo Chavez. It reminds me very much of during the Cold War, when the United States, when Washington couldn't see Latin America but through Moscow. And that led to a number of disastrous actions and support for all sorts of unsavory characters. So I think Barack Obama's statement yesterday from Moscow about the support for Zelaya, unconditional support for Zelaya, was a nice break from that. And I think that this insistence on seeing everything routed through Caracas, it just doesn't reflect what's actually going on the ground in Honduras.
I don't think we're insisting on that in this hour, but we are trying to look at interests at play in Honduras. What do you make of Honduran democracy? Jennifer McCoy's early observation that the poor there may feel unrepresented even in democracy. Arbo Vargas Llosa says, well, but the response has been authoritarian populism, and that's no good either. How do you look at this question?
Well, that's what I meant by seeing everything through the prism. I know this show hasn't done this, but Fox News and much of the mainstream media in the United States have insisted on seeing this through Caracas. And by using phrases such as authoritarian populism, I don't think that actually captures what's going on the ground. There's two things specific to Honduras that I think haven't been talked about. One is the absolute failure of the free trade agreement of Central America, CAFTA, which was promised to deliver prosperity and development, but actually has led to greater immiseration in Honduras over the last couple of years, a driving down of minimum wages. Honduras enters into competition with impoverished neighbors to attract capital. The trade deficit with the United States over the last couple of years has grown worse, and poverty has increased. And then the second thing is, of course, the disastrous war on drugs in Colombia through Central America and Mexico, which has strengthened something of a new class, a political and economic class, a kind of fusion of the old traditional landed class that we're used to talking about when we talk about Latin America, but a new out-of-east narco class, very much connected with illegal narcotics trafficking. It's been a complete disaster for all of Central America, and Honduras in particular has been hard hit. And I think what you're seeing here is a kind of climax of that crisis.
Greg Grandin, stand by in Guatemala City. We have so many listeners who want in here. Dave in Des Moines, Iowa. You're on the air, Dave.
Thanks. Yeah, I just don't want us to forget the oligarchy that controlled that area for most of the 20th century. And I personally had been to villages that had been raised in both Honduras and Guatemala by a U.S.-trained military in the name of whatever.
And when you say raised, you mean burned to the ground?
Burned to the ground. And in the name of whatever, you know, if this president was exploring his constitutional options to have a coup come in, and we just go, that's what they do in Central America, I find that appalling, given the history of the area and the fact that they are now struggling to have this representational democracy. And we pundits or people up here in the north can just go, I guess it's a military coup, and I guess that's okay. I mean, you know,
I don't hear a lot of people saying that. I have read essays out of Tegucigalpa itself saying the Honduran people are kind of confused about who to support here.
Well, they've always been confused, and I mean, you know, any kind of just simple, you know, a simple labor movement where military would roll into the hills and suppress this and burn people and kill people, and it doesn't get reported here, but this has been happening, and now this, like your one guest says, this is kind of transferred, this oligarchy has transferred itself into this narco whatever, but it's the same players. you know.
Yeah, Dave, I appreciate your perspective. That fusion is interesting. Narco money and old money. Thanks for your call from Des Moines. Let's get one right here from Medford, Massachusetts. Carlos, you're on the air, Carlos.
Yes, hello, Tom. I call for only one reason, is the question you pose on the program, which is what's next.
Yes.
And what is next is going to take place tomorrow in my home country, Costa Rica, in the Oscar Arias house, where both Zelaya and Michele are meeting, and they agreed to meet there. And I think what is important here, it's not really what has happened already, because that has been explained by your guest mm-hmm. in the program. But what is next is what is important to think about. And I want to hear from the three participants that you have right now, what is their take on what is going to happen tomorrow? Is Oscar Arias going to be able to come to a solution with the parties involved? And then what happens in the ground in Honduras? Whatever happens in Oscar Arias is really going to affect the people in Honduras. It is going to affect the stability there and promote economic growth, because that is what is going to matter, maintaining democracy in Honduras and longing for economic growth there. That's the most important question.
Carlos, let us go straight to it. You put your finger right on the big question. As you say, Roberto Micheletti, the head of the de facto government in Tegucigalpa now, I guess to be in, as you say, Oscar Arias' house in Costa Rica for this negotiation. Hillary Clinton, interestingly, yesterday stopped short of calling for Zelaya's reinstatement. She was asked whether the U.S. viewed his return as central to bringing back democratic order there, and she said she didn't want to prejudge the talks. Let me go to my three guests. Jennifer McCoy in Atlanta, first to you. What do you see coming in these negotiations?
Well, first, it's absolutely vital that there be negotiations, and it's too bad it hadn't happened up until this point. But it's very good that this will happen tomorrow with Oscar Arias, who has a lot of capacity in this regard. I think that what we're going to have to see, that there will have to be some kind of compromise. Both sides, both Micheletti and Zelaya, have laid out sort of uncompromising positions. One has to be returned. The other, no, if he returns, he'll be arrested. But they have both also indicated, given some gestures of some possible compromises. Micheletti has mentioned early elections. Zelaya has mentioned his willingness to be submitted to a legal process, some kind of trial where he could defend himself. And so,
a criminal trial or impeachment proceedings?
Well, the problem is the Honduran Constitution actually took out the impeachment process 5 years ago. That was taken out.
But I've heard impeachment discussed all over the place. It's really not an option?
No, it's no longer in the Constitution.
So it's a criminal trial or nothing. That's harsh.
Yes, something through the judicial mm-hmm. process. So there could be some, you know, the international community, and actually President Obama reiterated yesterday that he needs to be reinstated. So that is an unconditional demand of the, or let's say, a non-negotiable demand of the international community that he be reinstated. However, maybe it would be for a short term. That could be mm-hmm. a negotiation, and then he might step down even for a caretaker government to hold elections. Maybe the elections would be brought up early. There will probably be discussion of some sort of amnesty for all sides involved, possibly for those involved in the coup. And and then I think that what will be absolutely crucial is looking at the longer term. There will have to be some kind of international monitoring of whatever agreement arises from this mediation to make sure that all sides comply, to give reassurances to the Hondurans that all sides will comply. And finally, this long-term reconciliation, I think that Honduras will need some help, some outside help, with long-term reconciliation. It's very divided right now. Passions are very high. And this is dangerous for the society, and difficult to move forward to look for the kinds of reforms that are needed to ensure growth, to address poverty.
What kind of U.S. role should we see here? Of course, if we go back a couple of decades, the United States was all over Honduras as a base for opposing the Sandinistas in neighboring Nicaragua. It had a very heavy presence, much less now. Should the U.S. be, you know, up to its hips in this, or standing off? What?
Well, that's exactly part of the dilemma for the U.S. It does not have a stellar reputation in Central America, including in Honduras in the past during the Cold War. But now I think that the good thing about the Obama administration's reaction to this is that they clearly stood on principle to defend democracy even for a leader that was not politically convenient or close
friendly
to the United
mm-hmm.
States
mm-hmm.
and had been critical.
Mm. Álvaro Vargas Llosa, let me come to you. What next? What do you think will happen? What do you think should happen?
Well, it's great news. Oscar Arias is a man of great moral authority, and he will, in a way, allow for this process to come out of the hands of Hugo Chavez, who was really leading the Latin American response and had, of course, caused the government, the de facto government in Tegucigalpa, to just reinforce its own position and had polarized this discussion in a very inconvenient way. I think Arias is seen by everybody here as somebody who is an honest broker and who will be who will wisely try to steer this toward a some kind of negotiated solution. Ideally, Zelaya should go back and should finish his term, but he should do so under a very strict condition, which is to respect the Constitution and go home in January. The elections are supposed to take place in November, and then he should go home when the term finishes. That seems unlikely.
Why?
Because it looks like the position in Honduras is just
They won't want him back.
Non-negotiable, and this is probably going to lead to some kind of compromise on both sides. One possibility would be to bring the date of the elections forward, perhaps mm-hmm. with Zelaya in power, but only for a couple of months.
Mm-hmm.
That's one possibility. The other is that Zelaya doesn't go back to power, but he can go back into the country and he's given some kind of amnesty or immunity. But whatever happens, the important thing is elections need to take place, and they need a lot of international observers, perhaps the Carter Center, the OAS, mm-hmm. the European Union, I mean, as many as you can get in there, and give reassurances to the Honduran people that their democratic system is going to continue and to perfect itself.
I want to ideologize
this important discussion, because unfortunately there's been too much ideology thrown into this.
Maybe that's the solution, but I mean, how do you get away from ideology? I want to go to Greg Grandin in Guatemala City with the question of what next. But first, if I may just ask you about his observation, he's saying there's too much focus on Chavez here, too much phobia of Hugo Chavez and his way in Venezuela. I want to get your response to that, if I may, Mr. Vargas Llosa.
Well, I mean, unfortunately, that is what Chavez has caused. Of course, he has not only established an authoritarian system inside Venezuela by changing the constitution not once but twice, and now making it possible for him to seek permanent re-election. Imagine if somebody were to do that in the United States, what the response of the institutions and the people of the United States would be. But much more relevantly in this case for the discussion, he has sought to expand his revolution. He's very active across the continent. In fact, remember what the response was as soon as the coup took place in Honduras. Chavez threatened to invade the country and also established economic sanctions against Honduras, even though he is against economic sanctions when it comes to left-wing governments that are on the receiving end of it. So Chavez is part of the discussion because he has made himself part of the discussion. The great thing about this process that's now going to be led by Oscar Arias is that it's going to take Chavez out of the equation, and the farther away he is from the equation, the greater the possibility of some kind of solution to this terrible crisis.
Maybe out of it for the moment. Greg Grandin, Guatemala City, what next? What do you hope for? What do you see coming?
Well, obviously, hopefully this will be resolved in a peaceful manner and there will be no more violence and civil liberties will be restored in Honduras. I think it's important, whatever happens, that we step back and keep focused on the larger issue, that society is already polarized in Honduras, that Hugo Chavez didn't polarize society in Honduras. You mentioned earlier that 70% of the population lives in poverty, something along the lines of 50% live in extreme poverty. That the disaster of the Central American Free Trade Agreement, and I say free trade in quotation marks because there's nothing really free about it. It's been a disaster for countries like Honduras. And then, obviously, the failure of the war on drugs over the last 10 years, which has just escalated and accelerated violence up from Colombia into Central America and Mexico. It's a direct result of U.S. policy. So whatever happens, and hopefully it'll be a peaceful resolution in Honduras, and Zelaya will be restored immediately and unconditionally, and that the people responsible for the killings and the repression will be held accountable, that the larger issues at stake will be will be discussed and will be debated, and real solutions to the problem of poverty and the problem of violence and the problem of political exclusion.
We've just got half a minute. Do you see that as a real option, given that the military's just stepped in? Are we on the brink of a new age dawning in Honduras with that against that?
No,
backdrop?
But it is admirable the way the world has come out and condemned the coup. And again, we're not talking about Hugo Chavez. We're talking about the European Union. We're talking about the Organization of American States. We're talking about Spain. And we're talking about every responsible government has been very strongly. And that is something that we didn't see years ago during the aborted coup against Hugo Chavez in 2002.
Maybe that's a new trend right here. Greg Grandin, professor of history at New York University, joining us from Guatemala City. Thank you very much for being with us this hour. And Alvaro Vargas Llosa, joining us today from Washington. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Jennifer McCoy in Atlanta, Georgia, at the Carter Center. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
Listeners, thank you for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.